Yo, what's going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the mailbag!
That is right. I am Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Ryan Haley.
Sup, film fans and letter writers.
And we've got Raymond Creamer.
Hey, everybody.
And this week, as Ryan alluded to, we are going to be answering your questions. We're going to be doing a deep dive into the mailbag. So emails, voicemails, any fancy things that have come to us from Twitter, we're going to be addressing those things this episode. I don't know how many we're going to get through. Raymond, what do you think? You're the master of ceremonies for this episode. How many are we going to try to get through?
I've got like 15 on deck. I think a few of them are fast, a few of them are a little bit longer. We'll see what happens.
Fast and slow, as they say.
Yeah, so we're taking it fast and
absolutely.
Slow.
Absolutely. That's right. So we'll get into that. I do want to do just a little bit of housekeeping before we get started. You know, make sure you give us a follow over on Twitter, SMTM_POD, where we're sharing articles and other related thoughts related to the films that we address week by week. We've also got a Patreon, patreon.com/wisecrack, where we've been releasing bonus content where we talked about like the philosophy of acting. We talked about great debut feature films, what makes a great debut feature. We talked a little bit deeper about Apocalypse Now, etc., etc. So go to patreon.com/wisecrack for that. Make sure to check out the other Wisecrack podcasts, particularly Culture Binge, which is constant. And then, of course, you can check the Vault of the Squanch, which Ryan is deeply a part of. And what else? I guess there's the South Park podcast. We got the South Park, all the podcasts that are on that network. So go ahead and check out all of that goodness. And of course, keep sending us your thoughts and your feedback. You can email us, movies@wisecrack.co. You can call us at 1-213-534-8807. I finally have that number memorized. So, yeah, that's all of the housekeeping out of the way. So we're going to get into this mailbag. We're going to get through as many as we can. But, of course, before we do that, we got to pay some bills. So run it. All right, but before we continue, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor of this week's episode, Storyblocks. Look, y'all know the deal. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over a million royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. One of the things that's so badass is that you have unlimited downloads, which means you can kind of create on the fly. You can go in there and you can try out multiple options quickly so that you can create more and spend less time faffing about. You can create more videos and bring your story to life without sacrificing your vision due to time, budget, or resources. Honestly, every creator should really have a Storyblocks membership. I use Storyblocks. Wisecrack, we use Storyblocks. They're really fantastic because you can just get in there. You can find your After Effects goodies. You can find your sound effects. You can find music. And you don't have to worry about having to pay for any of this stuff because it's all right there and free. And then you plug and you pop it in. And if it doesn't work, then you go back to the library and you find one that suits. Look, you know the deal. Get over to storyblocks.com/wisecrack and you can learn all about their premium membership. That's storyblocks.com/wisecrack. Or, of course, you can click the link down below. All right, now back to the show. All right, Sick. So I'm going to turn it over to Raymond, who has his lists upon lists of emails and voicemails for us to go through. So, Raymond, take it away, brother.
Yeah, I've got the list. I'm checking it twice. Just a heads up, folks, if you hear your question on here, we did kind of massage these and edit them in some places just for the sake of the runtime. But we mean no disrespect, and we appreciate all the feedback. So the first question we got here is a pretty quick one from Shane Parvin about Moonlight. Hey everyone, longtime fan and listener. Thank you, Shane. I was wondering if any of you noticed similar themes or vibes in Moonlight and Nicholas Winding Refn films. I don't know why, but Moonlight and Drive seem similar to me. The neon lighting, the nighttime exteriors, romances that are rendered impossible through circumstance, and masculinity being performed as a facade. So thank you, Shane. I'll say right off the bat, Nicholas Winding Refn has kind of like lifted his leg on neon lighting in movies. So it's one of those things that's, you know, if you use certain kind of like high contrast color schemes in your movies, you're going to maybe court some comparison to him. He has a good reason. He's colorblind. I'm sure we've talked about this on the show. So that's one of the reasons that he goes for really high contrast lighting schemes so that he can better differentiate the elements within the frame. But what do you guys think? Some comparisons between Drive and Moonlight?
I mean, to me, it begins and ends with neon lights.
Yeah.
I think I can see that comparison. But yeah, the rest, I mean, cool take. I have to chew on it for a little bit.
I mean, I think when we're talking about certain themes like performative masculinity or something like that, that's such a broad concept that I think it seeps into the culture writ large in a variety of ways. So I think you're going to see it in a lot of things. I would say that if I were categorizing films, I don't think I would categorize Moonlight and like Neon Demon in the same together. But absolutely, I kind of agree with Ryan. I think in an intentional sense, there might be a sense in which Barry Jenkins is like, oh, sick, I love the neon colors. I love the bright contrast. Maybe he's had some sort of like drawn some sort of inspiration from that, but I don't think the relation goes much deeper than kind of just the general sense. But I think it's because, again, I think there's a certain zeitgeist, right, when that we can kind of tap into, and I think the issue of masculinity and how to explore that is something that is going to pop up and be expressed in a variety of different formats. And yeah, I think that's kind of where the comparisons end ultimately.
All right, this one. This is a little longer, probably the longest one we have. But I just wanted to give it some recognition because it was very thoughtful. Jessica Holmes wrote in concerning Black Widow. Hey, Wisecrack, Jessica from Alabama here. Love you guys so much. I in no one way want to be rude, but I was surprised at some of the things you may have missed in Black Widow. I saw this with my grandmother, and we loved it. I don't think it's a masterpiece, but there were some things that you guys said you didn't quite understand. So here's my 24-year-old female perspective on those. Melina Natasha didn't tell the others because they didn't have time. They decided to switch sides because of the conversation between her and Natasha and the photo album. Natasha's confession that your words kept me alive helped persuade her to side with her, and it made them see the other widows as people as well. On the comment about girls being disposable, being laughable and not making sense, anyone who has studied history at all should know that this is true. Jessica, I agree with you on that point. I think the comment in the movie is that the bad guy says that he references something to the effect of the most precious natural resource, and then he says young women. And I think if we were laughing about that line, it was just kind of like the way that it was phrased. Like, obviously we understand that you know, sex trafficking and sexual violence are no laughing matter. So apologies if that seemed reductive on our part. But it was just a very weird way to phrase that, and it kind of implied that to me at least, it implied that wars are being fought more over young women than they are being fought over like land or oil or what have you. And that was just a strange thing to float in there. But back to Jessica's email. As for the villain having no personality, she says she liked that. It sets you up to think that his daughter maybe could have been his saving grace and Black Widow took that from him. But no, he had her and he manipulated her. Some men are garbage to their daughters in worse ways than he was. That's a reality that every woman is raised with. I honestly don't care about his reasons. What he has done to these women is unforgivable. Humanizing him or making excuses or justifications would have been disgusting. And I think we're allowed a yeah, fuck him. He doesn't get our attention or our screen time. Instead, they spend time building a relationship between two women that has nothing to do with a man. But this is Marvel, so shit needs to blow up, because honestly, if it didn't, how many men would have come to see it? It wasn't my favorite thing either, but I have to admit that I got some sick satisfaction from watching a predator literally burn. That was a very intentional shot too. They cut back inside to watch him burn, as she states there. And she also mentions here at the end, this email may sound angry because I am, not at you guys, but at the fact that we have to have this discussion or model the villain after real people at all. Also, the movie is really angry too, and intentionally so. And she postscripts it with also OMG pockets. That's the most relatable dialogue ever. So what do you guys think revisiting Black Widow there? She raises some good points. And as I mentioned in the middle of the question there, we in no way meant to diminish the very real-world acts of violence on which that sort of stuff is based. But there were some kind of weird stilted dialogue moments. But what do you think about the other stuff there, Austin?
Well, I think the first thing I'm thinking about, if I can just kind of toss out something that's an academic sub-discipline, it's called social reproduction theory. And it kind of comes out of, I guess you'd call it like radical political theory, for lack of a better way to phrase it. And one of the ideas is that labor has to be reproduced somehow. And historically, in the domestic sphere, it's been the role of women that have done this. But the problem is that that labor that has allowed for men to have lunches and have meals at home or have the home taken care of or have all of the elements of domesticity taken care of, that hasn't been factored in economically, and it hasn't really been rewarded or given credit in any proper sense. But there actually is a lot of research out there that has tried to quantify how much value is in the domestic sphere or through care work or things like that. And so one of the things that I think that we can think of with Black Widow is that what they've done is they've kind of taken what is a sort of like abstract idea about like the value of womanhood and woman female contribution in society, and they've kind of turned it into something a bit more concrete, and they've made it into like a good guy, bad guy story. But I think that there is something really interesting if people want to study this further to kind of think about like, okay, what is there in the sense that actually the kind of role of standing in the societal subject position of womanhood, of what it's done in a socioeconomic sense to actually create value, and then what would it mean if you controlled that value and exploited it for gain, which is kind of what the baddie does in this, right? He's controlling the value of womanness, for lack of a better way of putting it, and he's creating great value on it, right? There's something along those lines there. I mean, it might be a bit of a stretch, but that's kind of where my mind goes when I was first watching the film. And if people are interested, check out Social Reproduction Theory or even like Marx feminism. There's a lot of stuff in that literature that kind of addresses these themes in diverging ways. But that's all I got to say about that.
Ryan, I think I've got another Black Widow follow-up here that I'm curious your thoughts on. From Jared Waltz, we've got a question. He says, I wanted to share some of my thoughts on Black Widow, and more specifically, whether the big CGI spectacle ending detracts from the more grounded character moments that the film has. Could it be that we are conditioned to mentally check out of a film when the action goes too big due to blockbuster films focusing too much on spectacle in general? Personally, I think there is a balance to be struck between sincerity and spectacle, and that Black Widow does so effectively. For my two cents, this question kind of reminded me of that. What's the old adage that, like, one death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic? And in some ways, like, escalation on screen has a way of like just inuring us to the stakes of it. But I don't know, Ryan, what did you think about the finale of that film? I can't recall from our previous discussion.
Well, it's funny that he put it like that, because during the whole discussion that you guys were just having, you know, about her well put email, I'm sitting here like racking my brain. It's hilarious to me, like, months after watching these movies, how it just immediately
is kind of in one ear and out the other.
You're talking about the baddie. I'm like, who was the baddie in that movie? I watched the whole fucking movie, you know, and it's just funny to me. Yeah. How, I saw a lot of things blow up. And then I left. I never thought about it again until right now. And I'm trying to remember it.
Well,
so I have no real, you know, comment. Just to me, the commentary is on how disposable.
Sure. Somewhat. I think we've kind of circled this topic so many times on Marvel movie discussions in the past. But do you guys think, I mean, even from like a philosophical perspective, Austin, do you think that we as a society have been like inured to violence on a grand scale, not necessarily through movies, but just through, as you mentioned, like social conditioning and stuff like that? Is it?
Yeah, it's a fucking problem. Like, it's a fucking problem. It's a fucking problem, right? Like, the fact that we can watch bodies be torn apart and that it doesn't like make us weep is a really interesting thing, right? Like, or that it just happens and it doesn't make us feel anything sometimes, right? Now, sometimes you see a body torn apart and you're like, ooh, gross. But then my question is do we have the rational skills to kind of like take that feeling, that sort of like visceral feeling, and think through it in ethical terms? Like, what does that mean about, should we respect the body? Should we respect life? Like, these are all these philosophical questions that I think don't often get addressed, because then you just have the next scene where a body's blown up, or you have the next film where a body's blown up, or the next video game where a body's blown up. And I'm not trying to say like the whole reductive video games make people violent. That's not it. But I also think it's extremely naive to think that the media that we saturate ourselves with doesn't have some sort of impact on shaping our thoughts, actions, and feelings. And so for me, it's important to figure out how can we navigate through that, not to reductively be like, it's either this or that. I'm more concerned with how we think about things.
I would push back on that a little bit, or disagree with it, basically, in the sense that I think it all matters, obviously, in how it's filmed and the quality of it. Like if you look like Saving Private Ryan, which to me is a, you know, giant scope movie, huge budget, and people are dying left and right, but it's like you feel it more because the stakes are set up in a way that's really human. You know, you know these
as well.
Yeah, there's gravity. You know that there's, and it holds up today. If you watch that movie, if a modern audience watches that movie at the beginning, the Normandy scene, they're not going to go just be unfeeling. I think they're going to go, wow, oh man, you know, like every death counts and matters. I think it's the way that these things are filmed. You got stuff, you know, stuff like John Wick or whatever, where literally it is a cartoon of just how can we murder people in different
in cooler ways.
And so obviously the audience is not going to like feel like every death and go, oh my God, that was a man. He had a family. They're just kind of like, oh yeah, that was cool. Let's go see the next one. And I feel like this, the Marvel stuff kind of has that weight to it where it's like the people are dying. And the Man of Steel was a big one that got a lot of flack for. It was like all these people are dying supposedly and no one cares. And it's just for this art entertainment. So and what does that say?
Yeah.
And I think it's just how it's filmed, you know, and then but I think that they went back later with the movies and you know, investigated the people, the human toll and whatever of that.
Yeah. Let me add one other wrinkle of complexity here. So we can think about things in terms of the personal, we can think about things in terms of the relational, we could think of the cultural, the societal, the global, the political, the economic, whatever. Right. So when we watch a film like Saving Private Ryan, it's also filmed from a particular perspective where we are meant to empathize with the cause of the troops that are landing on the beach. We're not supposed to give a fuck about the other people, the other side. So we dehumanize them all, and typically we're
yeah, not a lot of people rooting for the Germans during the first scene of Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
You see him as people, though. You know, like there's the scene where he's like, you know, they let him survive, and then I don't know.
I mean, the point isn't to be like, oh, we should have more empathy for the Nazis. That's not the point. But the point is to always be aware that whenever something's being filmed, it's being filmed from a particular perspective, which is one of the reasons I loved Eternals so much, was because Eternals was a human story, a multicultural human story, rather than the typical superhero film, which is very much patriotic, America is the best, right? And so the violence then still buttresses that sort of more global political, maybe even global economic stuff. And that's the stuff that we don't always have the resources to think about. And so it kind of unconsciously shapes how we view the goodness or badness or the compassionate response to violence as it plays out.
What I was going to say to that end, Spielberg, I said quite famously, I don't know how famously this aspect of his movies are, but in Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, he quite pointedly he doesn't subtitle the Germans. Like he intentionally renders them inhuman in that way by like
the other.
Keeping them unknowable and keeping them the other. Yeah, Ryan, what were you going to say?
I was just going to bring up Jimmy Snowman in the chat here, since this is the mailbag episode. I agree with what they say. They go, I also somewhat disagree. We know that movies and games are fake, detaching us from ethical or emotional responses. When watching actual footage of dead, torn apart bodies, most of us will respond. I mean, do you disagree with that, Austin?
To an extent, I would disagree. I think it's a little naive to think that if we watch bodies, whether or not we know that it's fake or real or play out on a screen, the whole point of immersive cinema is to manipulate our emotions in particular ways. I think that there is no such thing as a real distinction between quote real and quote fake. I think it's really more about in what ways is this real? In what ways is this alluding to us? It's the famous Baudrillard talks about how like the Gulf War didn't happen. What does he mean by that? Not that there weren't actually invasions, blah, blah, blah. What he meant by that was that the images that were fed are always already coded in media time by a narrative. So even when we watch footage of, for example, and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but let's just talk about it, the Kyle Rittenhouse footage, there's so many different ways to skew who was the aggressor, how did this happen, what angle is this, what events preceded this, what was your context, who were you, do you have a police record, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And the point is that nothing that comes to us is ever purely objective. It's always filtered, mediatized,
and narrativized.
Well, that's a good example, though. I mean, because that's real footage and stuff. So obviously you have, you know, these reactions you're talking about. But when you go to a theater or a play or something where there's this contract between the audience and the performers, where you're like, all right, I know that I'm coming to watch a fake theatrical presentation
of
something.
Yeah, they don't show snuff films at AMC. Yeah.
I mean, you're down for whatever, and because it's part of the thing that you bought into, you know. And I think that that's the big stark difference in terms of it's not. I don't think that makes you unfeeling if you get off on watching some really violent.
Exactly. But again, But again, that would be reductive, right? To say it makes you unfeeling. Again, I'm trying to navigate away from generalizations and say it's not that you either are unfeeling or you are empathetic or whatever. I want to say it's let's think more critically and with a lot of nuance when it comes to this, because I just don't think that we can be so. I don't think we can be so reductive to say that it's also benign that violence is played out on screen.
Sure. I want to keep things moving since we have 300 questions to get through. We got one on this note, just to put a button on this and kind of bring it back to cinema. Walter Bully wrote in with a comment about Suicide Squad. He said, I want to take a moment to shout out the fight between Rick Flag and Peacemaker near the end of the Suicide Squad. One thing I loved about their fight was that it was clearly a fight to the death, and as a viewer, I had no idea who was going to win. There was real tension in a superhero movie for once, because there was no guarantee that the good guy was going to make it. Good guy, in quotes. The film had clearly established that no character in the film is guaranteed to survive, with maybe the exception of Harley Quinn, since she's the franchise figure, and they show that fact as much as telling it. I just thought this was a good one to cap this conversation on, because it brings it back to the question that I'm always engaged with a movie, whether it's Black Widow or Eternals, or you mentioned Man of Steel, that to me, there are a lot of times where these movies become about, we need to do X or the world will end. And that just has kind of a deflating effect for me, stakes-wise. I like more personal, grounded, emotional stakes. You know, we talked about this on Tenet as well. But at any rate, I thought that was a good place to end that. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Not particularly. I love not knowing what's going to happen. And that's kind of, and I felt that way in Suicide Squad too.
Yeah.
It was a good movie. Well put together.
We got a quick one here from Dave's Not Here, asking, are horror movies the only place for daring artistic expression in film these days? He said he was tuning in for the Green Room episode, and it occurred to him that all the horror movies from the last decade from companies like A24, Neon, Spectrevision, etc., have really been putting out stuff that leans on the heady artsy side of things. Movies like Midsommar, Hereditary, The Lighthouse, The Witch, etc. This trend seems to be leaning more towards horror films being artistic. At one time, maybe dramas were the perfect outlet for artistic expression. Could it be that times have changed in a way that horror movies are more in the collective consciousness as an art form because of contemporary emotions that need to be expressed? I will offer a quick thought on this before passing it off, is that it's sad, but there just aren't a lot of dramas and comedies getting made anymore because they don't play well overseas and they can't make $1 billion. Horror movies still have a little bit better luck at the box office. It's a genre that's identifiable, and this isn't something that's new to contemporary horror. Wisecrack has actually done some videos to this effect, most recently one that I directed, horror has always been an engine for, you know, whether issues, social issues, social commentary, taking on bigger ideas wrapped in a genre casing. That way they can kind of like get notions across to audiences without hitting them too over the head. What do you guys think? Are there any examples that come to mind for y'all?
Well, yeah. And I would really add onto that they're cheap. That's the that's the golden reason why they're the
low risk, high reward. Yeah,
exactly. They're the indie filmmaker's best friend genre. But the one that comes to mind right now, you know, from the last 10 years is Get Out.
Absolutely.
Where that was, you know, such a big awards movie, cheap. It launched Jordan Peele, and then it kind of reinvigorated everyone else in the cast. It was. So yeah, there's something to that.
Yeah, me too. And then I would talk about Cabin in the Woods as being a film that I think is so self-aware and meta in what it is that horror films do and what it is they speak about and what type of release or what type of enjoyment does the viewer get from watching these films. But I think it does so in a way that is also critical. It's kind of like, well, should we? There's you know, the security guard in there at one point where, the Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins are kind of like talking about like they're doing something and, oh, we got to see this. And this is just the way it is to kind of pacify everyone. And then the security guard kind of goes, well, should they? Like, should we do this? And I think that's something that's really interesting for us to consider, is kind of like the ethical value of the catharsis that comes from exploring the monstrosity within the human mind and things like that. And so I think there's actually, I think horror films have always been interesting. I think that maybe now there's just a little layer of respect that's getting added to them. And I don't know if it's because we can't do dramas and romance, but maybe it's because we've become a little bit cynical and jaded, that maybe that's why horror is a perfect...
We definitely can still do dramas and romance. Studios just don't care to, you know.
Yeah.
Just not as big of a return on those. I will just say, to put a button on it, if you're more interested, if you're really interested in the history of horror as like a signifier of the times, there's a wonderful book written by David J. Scowl that's just called The Monster Show, A Cultural History of Horror. I would highly recommend it. It's a great read.
I was also going to add that just like, I think there was kind of a backlash there to just grind them up, you know, like Saw
and all those kind of movies.
Sure. Yeah, I think that.
But even those movies were speaking to contemporary anxieties. You know, people forget that the sort of torture porn and New French Extremity sort of came out of like post-Iraq invasion and photos of Abu Ghraib and stuff like that. But
I have a hot take. I think all film in one sense could be viewed as horror, because if we view art as being like commentary on like the human expression, it's all idealized versions of ourselves that we want to project about ourselves, whether it's like the best part, like, ooh, we're these romantic heroes and we're smooth talking, or ooh, we're sexy and beautiful, or ooh, blah, blah. But all of that is kind of all some idealized fantasy that could be bullshit in some way. And that's kind of horrific when you think about it. So maybe there's like this weird psychoanalytic perversion that we could kind of like say cuts through all artistic expression, but
an ending is only happy depending on where you place it. Moving on, we got tons of feedback on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yeah.
People really wanted to talk about that a little bit.
That's
more.
That's a
so
fucking horror movie.
Through some of these.
Okay, that's a fucking.
That is
movie.
Absolutely. That is an existential nightmare. Firstly, I wanted to say thanks. This is from Will Craven, by the way. I wanted to say thanks for the great discussion on Eternal Sunshine. This was the first podcast I had tuned into ever, but I love cinema, and this is my favorite movie of all time, so I got extremely lucky with the timing. I found it interesting that y'all and a few of the listeners agreed that this movie seems to hold great significance amongst folks our age. I also watched this movie when I was a teenager. None of my friends seemed to have the same regard for it, but they all watched it later than I did. The message of my email is this. At one point, you discussed Kaufman's early drafts where Joel and Clem were bound to this cycle of repeating the procedure. You said it would make the movie much more tragic and negate the themes of hope, but this is exactly how I see it. In the last few seconds, the clip of them running on the beach is looped a few times. It leads me to believe that they do make the same mistakes and erase each other again and again and again, but are led back to each other by fate. I still find hope and inspiration in this, but I also choose to recognize the movie as a reminder of the significance of the past and understanding that our pain is what allows us to progress as humans. What do you guys think about that?
I'm just going to say I concur.
I think it was well put. I think you covered a lot of the bases.
I love that.
Okay, so we'll move on. This one is a little bit more of a pointed philosophical question here. This is from Matthew Rotert. Apologies if I messed up your last name there, Matthew. On Eternal Sunshine. Hey, SMTM crew, I have a question about Eternal Sunshine. In The Life of Reason, George Santayana describes that when we overfixate on preserving memory, quote, all that happens is at once forgotten, and a vain repetition of the past takes the place of plasticity and fertile readaptation, end quote. This repetition is similar to his pain. Far from constituting its own remedy, tends only to its own continuance. Do you think that Joel and Clem's memories had become so intense and painful that they could only perpetuate that pain if they kept them, that they needed the distance and of their taped confessions to more optimistically and triumphantly for love remain plastic to new habits and suggestions, yet able to graft them on original instincts which they thus bring to fuller satisfaction, end quote. Is some pain so deep that we cannot incorporate it at all into a better us? A very profound question.
Yeah, I've heard it said before in psychotherapy that depression is when you can't let go of the past, anxiety pertains to the future, fear about the future. And I think that, I mean, whether or not that's overly generalized is up for discussion, but there's definitely something interesting in that. If you have experienced trauma, and I think that actually the definitions that we're starting to understand about what constitutes trauma are much broader than we typically did in the past. Before, it was always like, you know, like murders or assault or something like that. But I think it's much more about even like childhood neglect. You know, if you start reading about attachment theory and things like that, you know, depending on what type of parental or attachment figures you had in your life in kind of like the formative years, kind of shaping your emotional growth, that really kind of can be viewed in terms of trauma, and it can have lasting effects on us. The question is how do you become adjusted to those things by incorporating, by enfolding those things into a life that allows you to experience more expressions of secure attachment or secure groundedness as you move forward. And I don't think it's as simple as letting go of the past and just being open to the future. Or is it just simply like, you got to just embrace and affirm the past and be like, yes, that was me and I have no regrets. I don't think it's either of those things. I think this is really fucking difficult. And this is the not easy answer, because the not easy answer is a not easy solution. And I think it takes years and years and years of growth and study and internal reflection. And sometimes we need guidance, which means you talk to therapists, you talk to friends, you have wise elders, you look at the fucking wise people from the past. You are an artistic creator. You explore the world. I don't know what it is for everybody. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all solution, but I think that's basically the answer. And when we do that, we try to navigate this sticky experimental path of becoming better adjusted to trauma and anxiety. But it does seem like it is part and parcel of the human experience.
This is starting to sound like Owls at Dawn. What do you think, Ryan?
Yeah, I think I said in the pod, you know, I'm it's better to have loved than to have loved at all.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know? But I think that Charlie Kaufman, I'm not sure that he is one of those people, because I think that he would, you know, there is something to be said for you as a human being are like, God, that sucks so bad. And even though it's a part of my life, and yeah, I probably shouldn't want to go back in time and change it. Like what if I did? There's always a part of you that's like, you know, if I have the option, you know what, maybe it's better. And that's kind of a paradoxical situation, obviously, because you're not going to know if it's going to be better unless you do it. But then once you do it, you're not going to be able to go back. So that's obviously exactly the kind of situations Charlie Kaufman writes stories about. So, but you're right, Austin. I think that there's
no, and Charlie Kaufman seems to be just like a very sort of neurotic, insular, kind of solipsistic person.
He's a Patreon subscriber.
He's very much in his head, and I think that what that does is when you get so trapped sometimes in your own head, it becomes very difficult to get out. And I think that he's aware of that, though, right? And I think a lot of times he's exploring films or he's exploring ideas about trying to get out and make those connections. But I think he finds it very difficult. And so, you know, it's kind of the whole, what is it, Sonder? You know, the idea of like being able to actually connect and experience with, you know, to understand other people's, the fact that they are these like world creating, world living creatures. I think that's a very difficult thing to deal with. And for some of us, it's easier. And for some of us, it's much more difficult. And his whole shtick is that it's very fucking difficult or impossible. You know,
you can't learn from something you don't remember. We've got a question here from Luke Beebe to put a cap on the Eternal Sunshine discussion. Luke Beebe, I call him the Irishman because I heard he paints houses. He says, first off, I love the podcast. I was painting houses this summer and listened to about 4 episodes of Show Me the Meaning a day till I got through about 90% of your back catalog. And I'm going to assume about 100% brain damage after that diet.
That was from sniffing the paint, though. So
I was
a carpenter for a long time, so, you know, every once in a while I get it. Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty great getting paid to listen to you all chat about movies all day. Hey, glad we could help, man. A few weeks ago, I watched Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and listened to your episode on the film. I loved it, and as someone who is not well-versed in movies or plays, this was the first time I saw a relationship analyzed in reverse. With that concept in my head, I was listening to Austin's podcast, shout out Owls at Dawn, where there was a reference to a Kierkegaard quote, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." It struck me that there are probably some important ideas there if multiple thinkers and artists are exploring the concept. Was hoping to get your takes on the quote, which I don't fully understand. Okay, thanks for your candor, Luke, and how it might relate to the film. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. And Luke, you keep up the great work, and be careful up on that ladder, man.
Thanks, Luke. Hell yeah.
What do you think there, Austin? You remember that discussion to which he's referring?
Yeah, it was based, it was from the fucking Mads Mikkelsen film, Another Round, where the Kierkegaard, it factors quite heavily. So for the existentialists, they viewed the sort of like thrownness of human existence, which is that you're thrown into a condition that is not of your own choosing, right? You don't choose where you're born. You don't choose the family you're born into. A lot of things that you don't have control over. But at the same time, you do have some sort of capacity for agency, right? And so that the real responsibility that's laid at your feet is to, one, be aware of the past that has formed who we are, but to then therefore have like this bold, active, forward-looking outlook on how it is that we're then going to create out of those conditions. So we can think of it like an artist. An artist doesn't create out of nothing, right? There's no creation ex nihilo. You already have colors and color palettes in the history of artistic creation, and you have a canvas that has, you know, parameters within which you must work. And of course, artists are always trying to break those parameters and work outside of those things. But nevertheless, even when you do that, you're already carrying the parameters with you in your overcoming of them, right? And I think that's the idea, is that past, present, and future all converge at the same moment, and we can only create forward by having some sort of attunement, respect, and affirmation of the conditions or the past that have formed us. And I think that's kind of the idea.
Ryan, any thoughts to add? Just anything at all before we move on from Eternal Sunshine?
No, that was very succinct, Austin. I love that movie.
Fucking great one.
We've got a quick hit here, another one from Matthew Rodert. He's got two on the board. Apocalypse Now and Alien he's talking about here. He said, leaping off Raymond's comment about Alien also debuting in 1979, do you think there is a worthwhile comparison between Kurtz and the Xenomorph? In his I've Seen Horrors monologue, Kurtz ends on the need for using, quote, primordial instincts to kill without feeling passion or judgment, because it's judgment that defeats us. This notion echoes Ash's admiration of the alien as a survivor, unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality. Further, the thing Kurtz has become shifts constantly between lucid moral philosophy and brutal psychopathy. Beyond referencing the xenomorph's shifting form, Ash might describe this oscillation with, quote, its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility. So what do you guys think? Anything that that binds these two movies other than their release dates?
How close are they released?
I don't know the actual dates. They were the same year. I mean, I would say they're both quite obviously in the shadow of the Vietnam War. Apocalypse Now, explicitly so. Alien has those touches of like anti-establishment like sentiment. Yeah. You know, you find out, I can't remember if it's in the first movie or the second one, that you find out like it's very anti-corporatist. You find out that Weyland Yutani is, you know, sort of feeding these people to the aliens as part of like research and development and trying to get them back for you know, for exploitation in the military and things like that. But
the first film opens, they're like a freighter for what is it, whatever the fucking material is, but it's like, you know, billions of pounds or tons or whatever the fuck it is of whatever the resource is. So there's an economic and kind of like political theme that's clearly there at the outset, you know.
I mean, it's interesting, just the subgenre of men on a mission through, you know, I guess the jungle or space. What was that one that came out recently with Brad Pitt going out to the middle of nowhere?
Ad Astra.
In space.
It's basically
Ad Astra
in space, yeah. It's
really which is basically, and Apocalypse Now is basically a Guerra of the Wrath of God, the Werner Herzog. Just, I don't know.
I think that humans Yeah, humans have always tried to kind of, especially like the modern or postmodern human, has really been fascinated with the kind of binary between nature and culture, right? Like the wild and the tamed, or the civilized and the uncivilized, or, you know, some of these binaries. And so I think that that's always going to be explored, because that which is completely beyond us, that which is completely quote unquote wild, is terrifying. So that's where the horror, I think, comes from. And so the question is that horror somewhere out there? Is it an alien? Is it a monster? Is it space? Is it trees? Is it the dark? Or is it something that can be inside? Is it, you know, the heart of man, the heart of darkness, you know, those kinds of things. So I think that's really what binds these films. And it's something that's just like a really common theme to explore kind of in the history of the West, especially post-World War II, right? Where you have supposedly technology was supposed to come and save us and usher us into, like, you know, 16-hour work weeks is what Keynes thought, and you know, there'd be abundant resources for everybody
counting on Festus to bail us out after
yeah, what the fuck, man. But that's not what happened. We fucking annihilated people with bombs and all kinds of different military technological advancements. So it's something that, like, famously, you know, a lot of philosophers kind of have focused on this quote. It's like, can you do poetry after Auschwitz? You know, like can you do art? Can you like, what does it mean to be human and to explore ethics in the world and beauty and things like that in the face of the horrors of what the human can do? So these are all themes that I think we're kind of like seeing get wrestled with in all of these films.
And while, oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, The Thing, yeah, John Carpenter's The Thing is a good example of that, of like, oh, you know, yeah, you're thrust in this situation, but it's about darkness of man. But I will say, I get a little tired of that theme too. Like Quiet Place Part Two kind of did that, where it's like, oh, it's not the big monsters you need to worry about, it's the people's reaction to it. And and kind of like a million seasons of The Walking Dead.
I think that was literally their tagline, was like, avoid the dead but fear the living, or something like that.
That kind of, yeah, thing. Yeah, you know, like I think that trope can kind of get overdone, but that's just my opinion.
Well, speaking about movies that share certain through lines, we got a few questions about environmental themes in different movies, many of which were about the Green Knight specifically. So I chose one from Danny Blue. That was a very thoughtful message here. He says, I saw The Green Knight as heavily commenting on our relationship with the environment, maybe not the original material, but certainly the imagery through the translation to film. The Green Knight is born from a plant. He comes to them on a winter holiday when all the trees have been cut down to supply heat to the court. He offers a deal. The excess of damage you inflict on me will be dealt back in the future. It's obvious he should just give him a kick or a scratch, but he uses a tool, not a weapon, to cut off his head, and seemingly no one is worried about the problems this will lead to in the future. Through the two short year, he is worried about his retribution. I felt it was a similar gut feeling of dread to that of ours today worrying about climate change. There's even the denial talk, some trying to force their thinking to be more of a joke or a game that they will never have to think about again. He's constantly thinking ahead now, referring to Gawain. When he is near death, tied up in the forest, the camera spins in a clockwise or forward in time direction to show where he fears he will be in the future, then spins back counterclockwise to show present day again. I think his mother orchestrated the whole thing as a test and to teach him the five chivalrous traits a knight should have. Once he fails them all on his journey, he flinches, but after thinking of his legacy, he passes the test and now has a story to tell and is a man of honor. I know we touched on questions of the environment in that film, and David Lowery has even stated pretty explicitly in several interviews that he sees aspects of it as an environmental metaphor. But I thought Danny Blue here had a few good points that we didn't necessarily touch on. What do you guys think?
I mean, I thought it was
he covered all the bases himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, to wrap up that email, he says, cheers from a lockdown Melbourne. So Austin, maybe when you guys get out of lockdown, you can meet for a drink and talk it over.
We're out now.
Oh, yeah?
We're out now. Well, mostly out. Yeah.
And he also recommends Under the Silver Lake if we ever have an open slot to fill movie-wise. Okay. More environmental discussion. We have an email here from Dylan Williams about Snowpiercer. This was a very, very long email, so I just kind of have the beginning of it to give us the gist before passing it off to you guys. He says, sorry I'm a little late on this one, but I just listened to the episode on Snowpiercer, and I wanted to talk a little bit about everyone's favorite topic, capitalism. Specifically, I wanted to talk about the conversation that you guys had at the end of the episode about whether or not having the polar bear was a cop-out to make the movie Hollywood-friendly. Mm-hmm. I think that the ending with the polar bear is somewhat transgressive, even within the anti-capitalist framework. A recent book that's been getting a lot of play in philosophy circles is Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism. If you're unfamiliar, the central conceit of the book is that, quote, it is easier to imagine an end to the world than an end to capitalism. According to Fisher, capitalist realism has so captured public thought that the idea of anti-capitalism no longer acts as the antithesis to capitalism. Instead, it is deployed as a means for reinforcing capitalism. This is done through media, which aims to provide a safe means of consuming anti-capitalist ideas without actually challenging the system. This is something we've kind of nibbled around on several conversations. One that comes to mind is like Judas and the Black Messiah, where it's like, yeah, you know, it's obviously it's sort of woven through with anti-capitalist sentiment, but it's still being made by fucking Warner Brothers. You know, it's sometimes difficult to sort of split those hairs a little bit. But what do you guys think, Austin? Have you read that book?
Yeah, I did graduate research and PhD research in the UK when Mark Fisher was around, and he was a part of the cybernetics research crew out of Warwick, and my external PhD examiner was also a part of that crew and was really good friends with Mark. So very familiar with the book and Mark's research. He also used to be a prolific blogger back in the day when I was first starting my master's degree, and he has a great, great online resource. So if people are interested, check out his stuff. Also, that quote is really a Frederick Jameson quote that Zizek has used, Fisher has used as well. So if people are interested, Frederick Jameson is somebody that we've talked a lot about on the Wisecrack channel as well. I mean, the basic idea is this, is like, can you break out of a sort of hegemonic idea, an idea that has its tendrils in everything? And I think that's a really difficult theoretical question. You know, for some people, there's something called accelerationism, and people within Mark Fisher's immediate sphere, particularly people I've worked with, Nick Cernik and Alex Williams, they wrote a book called Inventing the Future, Post-Capitalism in a World Without Work, which I produced the documentary, kind of experimental avant-garde adaptation of, kind of played with this idea of acceleration, which the way out is through, right? A sort of like retooling of the tools of an exploitative capitalist system, but in a way that would be much more inclusive, much less exploitative. So that's kind of one way forward. I guess whipping this around then and talking about Snowpiercer, what do we think about the end of Snowpiercer? I think that what you get at the end of Snowpiercer is really this, it's kind of like you get these two worlds. One is blow everything up, derail the train, and then you have a possibility for transformation. Or it's could not Chris Evans' character, can't remember his name at the moment, could he not take over the engine room and somehow reform the system from within, right? That was like the big debate that a lot of people even wrote us in and asked us questions on. I think that the approach that the film takes is that you blow the fucking thing up, and you know what? Maybe there's a chance for survival, but then the joke is this, like you get out and there's a fucking polar bear that's gonna eat you, right? So like, yeah, you get out and it's, so I don't think that it's actually some sort of like positive, like, yeah, we're gonna derail the train and survive in the middle of fucking Siberia or wherever they are. They're gonna starve to death, they're gonna freeze to death, and then their body's gonna get eaten by a polar bear, and then maybe that's better. Maybe fucking destroy humanity is what the film is actually saying. I don't know. I'm not saying that that's a good solution, but fuck, that's at least one of the things that the film's
definitely
kind of putting out there.
Out of the frying pan and into the tundra. Ryan, what do you got?
Don't you think that it really is, the movie is trying to say, like, you know, life found a way, and that they're going to end up ultimately making it, and that it's a happy ending?
Could be. There's, I mean, it could be suggesting that life can be sustained outside the walls of Snowpiercer, but for what species and for how long? And are these people who have only known the walls of Snowpiercer their entire lives prepared to live it? I mean, it's an ambiguous ending, you know? Some, you could read hope, you could read tragedy.
Yeah, I go tragedy. That's a horror film. They're all horror films.
Speaking of, this is our last subject here. This is sort of glancingly about the environment, but I'm going to make it about the environment because I missed my first chance to do this months ago. We have a voicemail from Logan about Pacific Rim. So can we roll that voicemail, Matt?
Hey, Wisecrack, it's Logan here, calling after listening to your Pan's Labyrinth podcast. I wanted to talk a little bit about Guillermo del Toro and his themes regarding monsters. Now, I've always associated del Toro with monsters, but I've never really realized how much he empathizes with them until rewatching a bunch of his films back to back. With that in mind, would you guys say that Pacific Rim goes against his usual themes regarding monsters? I enjoy that movie a lot, but I never feel empathetic with the monsters. Even with the neural link thing with the monsters that happens, I feel as if they aren't really sympathetic characters. Feel free to tell me why I'm wrong or what I'm missing. Also, I'd love if you could cover more Bong Joon-ho films. I feel as if he's one of the greatest living filmmakers, and I would love to hear you guys covering more of his work. Appreciate the podcast. Peace.
Thank you for calling in, Logan, and I will take an opportunity just to speak to it. The basic gist of the podcast is he was asking about how throughout Del Toro's career, he really empathizes with monsters, basically until Pacific Rim, when they're kind of exclusively painted as the bad guy. The reason that I said I whiffed on this one was that, Austin, when you and I did our two-man Enter the Drift conversation about Pacific Rim, it was pretty early in my tenure on the show, and folks, a little peek behind the curtain, it wasn't necessarily that I was gun shy.
Were you gun shy?
A little peek behind the curtain. In addition to this conversation, as you all know, we try to keep an eye on the chat. There were only two of us on that one, so it was like I had Austin in one ear and then, the chat in one eye. And I was just, my focus was split. He asked me an absolute layup question at the end, perfectly setting me up to talk about climate change. And I completely whiffed because I barely heard what he was asking. But you basically asked the same question. That what do you think it means that these monsters are treated as monsters and they're not humanized within the context of the film? And I was so beaten up, I was killing myself over fucking whiffing on this one, that I actually went to YouTube and posted a comment underneath the video as like a mea culpa, because we didn't address climate change at all in the Pacific Rim episode, but I want to take an opportunity to do that now. So I am reading a prepared statement from the YouTube comment section of our SMTM episode about Pacific Rim. I wanted to acknowledge the kaiju as climate change angle, which is a major theme we somehow overlooked during our discussion. The movie makes a huge point of that with the kaiju's hurricane-like category system, explicit mentions of Earth's carbon concentration already making the planet more hospitable for the precursors, the ghoulish government bureaucrats planning to build a coastal wall and retreat inland, the framing of the situation as a global problem that requires global solutions, and, most vitally, the presentation of the kaiju as something more akin to forces of nature than movie villains who are driven by any conscious objective. Austin brought up that last aspect near the end of the pod, and I've been kicking myself all day for how poorly I articulated my response to his prompt. Additionally, this movie is paying homage to a long history of kaiju films, many of which are explicitly about humankind's constant antagonizing of nature and hubristic desire to play God, most popularly with the anti-nuclear messaging in the original Godzilla, which is one of my all-time favorites. All that to say, there were tons of opportunities to acknowledge climate change on this podcast, and I completely struck out. The reason that I wanted to bring that up is that people did call me out in the chat and in the comments of the YouTube section for not talking about that. And I will say, in addition to all the preamble, that there are some movies like Green Knight or Titan or the one we were just discussing 2 seconds ago, Snowpiercer, that are clearly like dealing with some environmental subtext but may not come out and explicitly say it. Pacific Rim comes out and explicitly says it. And sometimes, I can only speak for myself, but sometimes when we're on the show discussing movies, when stuff is so much on the surface, we can kind of miss the forest for the trees because, you know, we assume everyone has caught on to that thing and it just, you know, we only have an hour to do this and we're doing it live. And I'm sorry, folks. I missed out there. And in closing here, I said, I mentioned on the pod that Del Toro's aesthetic fascinations can sometimes lead him to miss the forest for the trees. Then I did that very same thing during this discussion by zeroing in on all the cool little aspects of this movie, its universe, and the ideas that it personally inspired in me, rather than centering the discussion on what the filmmaker gave to all of us, which is what this podcast is really all about. So consider this my mea culpa. It is the last apology any of you fans will ever get.
All right, Austin. We forgive you're forgiven.
You're forgiven.
I was beating myself up because I consider myself this podcast climate envoy, and boy, oh boy, did I let everybody down. So moving on from that one.
I'm excited for Don't Look Up, the climate Adam McKay movie.
Very excited to see that. He's been talking that one up for a while. Let's pivot to we have here a question about Dune from Isaac Viafana. Apologies, Isaac, if I messed up your last name there. He says he starts off pretty hot. It's going to be a no for me on Dune. He says, yes, it is visually and aesthetically pleasing as a whole, but it's succeeding in creating the proper tone surrounding the themes and ideas echoed in the book. But while the cinematography and score were well executed, I didn't find it successful as a whole because it missed the mark in other departments, specifically in its adaptation of the story. Whether or not you've read the book, a writer should be able to tell a story well enough to get investment from the audience. This has become a big pet peeve of mine, he says, making 3-hour long films and sacrificing story. If the 3-hour runtime is important and necessary, then use every minute of those 3 hours to make up for any of the film's shortcomings. Maybe Dune would have been a more interesting as a visual film with experimental elements like Tree of Life, but what do you guys think? What makes a good adaptation? I feel like we've kind of touched on this before, but specifically in the context of Dune, what do y'all think?
I think that in the context of Dune, and I mean, I feel bad hammering on this, but the splitting up was a bad way to do it, if I would do say so myself. I think it should have either been a mini series, or they should have ended it in a different way, or truncated it. But those are my thoughts on how they adapted Dune.
Yeah, I think we're. This is one of those questions I think we kind of already covered previously, in a way.
I will say this, though. I actually have kind of a, maybe a fringe take. I don't give a shit about, like, fidelity to the original source. I actually don't care. Like I don't, when people are like, oh, it's not true to the source, I don't give a shit. Like, that's not the job of the filmmaker to somehow, like, bow down to the author before them. Like, I kind of don't really care. I think that film is its own language. It's its own expression. It's doing its own thing. And I love the idea that someone can be like, hey, this is inspired by this thing, but I'm going to do what I want. That's not why I don't like Dune. Like, yeah, there are things that I feel like the book handles differently that is interesting to talk about as a comparison, but it doesn't, like, make one better than the other because one is, the themes are more fleshed out, or the story kind of goes in this direction. I really don't give a shit. For me, the film just wasn't something that I thought ultimately worked because I thought it was a bit slow. I thought kind of the acting was a bit wooden. I thought the trailer oversold Zendaya's role, which I thought was kind of weird. I feel a little bit like it was manipulative to try to get people, and that kind of always pisses me off when they do that. I mean, there were a bunch of things that I just didn't love about the film as itself. I don't think it stands or falls because of its fidelity to the original source.
I would agree with you. I think we talked about this weirdly enough on the Street Fighter episode. A fucking decade ago, whatever it was, that to me, what makes a good adaptation is when you can sort of isolate the spirit of the source material. You know, your mileage may vary. I think we were talking about Charlie Kaufman earlier. His last film was a not at all faithful adaptation of a very good book. And I enjoyed the book and the movie both immensely because I think he finds sort of the beating heart of it and sort of takes it in a Charlie Kaufman direction. Another great study in contrasts, if you're interested in, like, the art of adaptation, is from the year 2007. I would highly recommend reading both No Country for Old Men and Oil by Upton Sinclair, because two of the best movies from 2007 were both adaptations. No Country for Old Men is almost like a word-for-word lift from Cormac McCarthy's book, whereas Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, it barely has anything to do with Upton Sinclair's book. He kind of, like, takes the character names and, like, the first third of the book, and then he creates a new second third act and creates entirely new character dynamics around it, but it's still a phenomenal adaptation. And I think two of the best movies, probably the two best movies from that year.
That's a good point in terms of how different they are from the source material. I think the best and most obvious contrast for Dune is freaking Lord of the Rings. Because, I mean, as someone who didn't read those either, like, I can, you know, to me, Lord of the Rings, I can watch it as a non-Lord of the Rings reader and still be like, wow, all right, sure. I'm following what's going on.
A very different type of movie, even though they're both obviously fantasy and But no, I'm agreeing with you. What I'm saying is, like, the energy of Lord of the Rings is a lot different than the energy of a Denis Villeneuve film, and I think that also may keep a 3-hour movie at arm's length when it's paced like a Denis Villeneuve film. All that is well and good when it's, you know, 90 minutes. But so we're gonna wrap things up, but we got one more question from the Eternal himself, Matthew Rodert, going for the hat trick today, and he has a question about Eternals, the multiverse, and postmodernism. Hey boys, even though not narratively tied to the multiverse, isn't Eternals thematically linked? Both seem to express an incredulity towards meta-narratives, a la Jean-Francois Lyotard's definition of postmodernism. The Eternals all eventually reject their purpose in fulfilling Arishem's grand design. Most outright rebel. Icarus even immolates himself to avoid the choice. Does it seem fitting that the MCU should explore the death of God, the author, and meaning after the passing of Stan Lee, of all things? So, what do you guys think? There's some something to nibble on there philosophically, and also some good popcorn discussion there.
Popcorn first.
Popcorn first? Well, how do you think Stan Lee's passing has shaped the Marvel Universe? Do you think it has done really... I would argue that Stan Lee was not really the creative force behind the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Obviously, his characters are being interpreted for that. Well, I mean, it's Kevin Feige, I would say. I don't know how much... It is kind of a neat coincidence that he touches on there that, you know, a movie that is so concerned with sort of spectral planes or however you want to define it would come after the death of the grand author within the Marvel canon. But I mean, Stan Lee was like in his 80s, he's getting on there in age. Like I'm pretty sure you may be able to project that onto whatever Marvel movies came after he eventually passed away. Because I assure you, they will continue making Marvel movies long after all of us have passed away.
That is the truth.
But,
What
do you think about some of those philosophical precepts, Austin?
Yeah, so what Lyotard's really getting at in the postmodern condition is he's getting at there's a sort of like a lack of belief, a lack of trust in the what are called self-legitimizing meta-narratives. And Lyotard's in a big debate with like Jürgen Habermas and some others of that time period. And the idea is like, how does one legitimize authority, so like the monarch under the divine right of kings was like God is legitimizing the authority. The nation state is basically like what? It's a constitutional or some sort of like the people give it legitimacy. And so the question is like once you start to kind of even question the source of legitimacy for a power, you then start to find yourself in very shaky ground because the foundation is not as solid as you thought it may have been. So if this film, and obviously Wisecrack, I think we did a great video on this, if this film is really about sort of death of God, what you're ultimately doing in a very Nietzschean sense is you're detaching yourself from any sort of foundation, or as Nietzsche talks about, detaching the mooring. So you're basically like a ship floating out in the middle of the sea without a map, without a compass. You're not attached to anything. You don't have land in front of you. You're kind of trying to figure things out by what? Reading the stars or following the wind or something like that. And what that does is that creates a very sort of precarious human condition. And so I think that absolutely these films are doing that. But again, this is the zeitgeist of the time. We are looking at the authority figures around us, and we are either politically apathetic or skeptical or cynical because we've been jaded, we've been fooled so many times, right? It's the famous George Bush, fool me once, shame, you fool me, you can't get fooled again, But
verbatim.
Yeah. But fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you, the sort of thing where it's like, I'm sorry, other way around, but the idea is, again, is like we have been jaded and we have maybe kind of learned a bit about like how to kind of figure things out. And it is very Nietzschean, and Lyotard himself is very influenced, as are all the French kind of post-structuralist, post-phenomenologists, very influenced by Nietzsche's sort of attacks on the authority figures, on the self-legitimizing authority figures of God, state, etc., etc. And so I think you're going to continue to see this in the Marvel films because there is a sort of cultural zeitgeist where we are skeptical of the state and we are skeptical of military and we are skeptical of the power figures that pat themselves on the back and they say, we are here and we have authority and we're doing good, right? Which again, look at Suicide Squad, you have the Patriot, right? Who then ends up being a kind of like, right? So again, it's like, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys and how do they get their authority and what does that mean for us? I think we're going to see this explored a lot with all of the films moving forward, whether or not they're kind of like intentionally trying to do so or not. I just think it's kind of in our social unconscious, so to speak.
It's in the zeitgeist at this point.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I mean, we're running a little bit over, but I think that's it. I'd say we should go to the mailbag real quick, but I don't think we have time. what do you think, guys? Should we wrap it up?
Ryan, final thoughts?
Throw out a movie or two that we've liked that from this year so far.
Did on the podcast or just in general?
Or just in general. I'm not sure if I brought this one up again or yet, but No Sudden Move, the Soderbergh movie, I loved.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Did you like it, Raymond? Did you watch it?
I haven't watched it yet, but I love Soderbergh. I'm excited to watch it.
It was great. Card Counter was great. Paul Schrader's Card Counter.
Love Schrader.
Those are two that I really dug. I liked Barb and Star. Go to Vista Del Mar.
It's not for everybody,
but I liked it.
I'm bummed I wasn't on the episode where we talked about Titan. I went and saw Titan at the Sydney Film Fest, and I thought it was fucking fantastic. It, like, got my creative juices flowing again. I also saw the new Jane Campion film, The Power of the Dog. While I didn't love certain aspects of it, which I don't want to kind of spoil here because I don't want to sour anybody's experience of it. I thought it was really interesting, and it definitely stirred up a lot of discussion, let's say. That's something to look forward to.
Most of my favorite movies from this year we've actually covered on the pod. Green Knight, Judas and the Black Messiah. We've been doing Talking Titan for like 30 weeks now. I'm still going strong on that one. But I will throw out one that we haven't discussed on the podcast, starring Nicolas Cage. Pig, folks. If you haven't seen Pig, highly recommend it.
Pig.
It's a lovely performance from Nicolas Cage. A really beautiful story that without giving away any spoilers, it's constantly zigging when you expect it to zag. It knows exactly what you think it's going to be. And it's not that it's trying to subvert your expectations, but it's just trying to do its own thing and tell a really, really simple and lovely story. I highly recommend it.
I appreciated Pig, did not love Pig. That's my two cents. and I feel like there was one. Oh, I follow up. I did not love French Dispatch, dude.
I really enjoyed French Dispatch. I don't know that it would be one of my favorites of Wes Anderson's, but I liked it quite a bit. But I also, maybe this is the Dune thing. I knew what I was getting into. Yeah. I'm trying to think. Anything coming up? Licorice Pizza, I'm excited to see. Nightmare Alley, speaking of Del Toro.
Ghosts of Prisoners of the Ghostland, I still need to see that. The Nick Cage, Sheehan Sono movie.
There's a lot of stuff that's going to be coming out still in the last couple months of the year, but we will not be discussing any of it because we are too fucking busy talking about Adam McKay's Step Brothers next week on the podcast. One of my favorite movies. Very, very excited to talk about Step Brothers with y'all. A little something to look forward to as we go into the holiday season. But for now, what do you think? Should we sign off?
Send us out of here, Ryan.
Ryan, where can they find you?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about all that shit. This felt like a bonus episode. Yeah, so I was like, let's go.
It's gonna be a Ryan Shorts on YouTube and Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that. Ryan's Game Show. Yes, Raymond.
And speaking of the Patreon, patreon.com/wisecrack. And you can find me.
Find me on Twitter. Austin_Hayden. Insta, AOS_HAY, Raymond.
Apparently, I swear I'm never hosting again. You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. Ryan, for the second time today, send us home, brother.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California. This has been Show Me the Mailbag.